CinemaSins has a fan club. It's called the Sin Club, and members get all sorts of things like early episodes, bonus videos, merch discounts, and even monthly bonus podcasts. Membership starts at $3 a month, and you can sign up now at patreon.com/CinemaSins.
I said, hey, you know, whatever you're comfortable with, I'm down for hugs, elbow bumps, fist pumps, handshakes, high fives, and he just writes all the above, baby, period, you know. And it's like, man, gotta love Glenn.
Welcome to Sincast, presented by CinemaSins.
Welcome to the Sincast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by Jonathan Watkins.
Hello, hello.
And today we are speaking with a very special guest. It's director Josh Rubin. His movie Werewolves Within comes out in theaters June 25th and on demand July 2nd. Josh, welcome.
How are you? You know, how are you guys?
How are you indeed? If we're going to do puns and stuff, we might as well go right off the bat. Like, how the hell is the writer of this movie called Mishna Wolf anyway? I'm sure she's already gotten that a whole bunch, but
it's a total mess. And she's taken each punch so elegantly on each talented cheek. Yeah, I know. It's a miracle. You know, it's his will. You know, I don't know. And how do they get a guy with a last name that is a sandwich to direct it? No idea.
Right. Right. That's what I was sitting there thinking the whole time. Okay, so let's go right into your cast. I think we need to talk about your cast first on this, because you've populated it with a whole ton of recognizable character actors. If you've watched any comic television show of any sort or anything like that, you recognize these people. Of course, you recognize Sam Richardson from Veep and stuff like that. You also recognize Milana Weintraub, of course, mm-hmm. AT&T commercials, and you know, just there's so many people in this. So tell me what your process was in getting this incredible cast for this
movie. Oh man, there were so many different routes. You know, you with all these films, studio films and the like, you have a big board, you make your kind of wish list, your sort of dream list. I always knew that, you know, that I wanted to work with friends. I tasked the casting director, Gail Keller, to enact a no assholes policy. So everyone that kind of came through was like, I've heard that one's a bully. I've heard that one carries and falls very, very strongly on one end of the political spectrum. Maybe we shouldn't have that, but I did know I wanted buddies. I wanted friends, because we were going mm-hmm. to the middle of nowhere. I did my first film was, you know, a little bit closer to civilization, but still in the Hudson Valley, you know, near Woodstock, New York. This is in Fleischmann's. This is another 40 minutes out, kind of towards, you know, not desolation, but sort of, you know, we're going to be like summer camp, but in the winter. So winter camp, bring a buddy. I knew from the get-go I wanted George Basil, George, who plays Marcus in the film, mm-hmm. who's been on,
yes,
you know, like Crashing and Flaked and Wrecked, and he's done all these kind of awesome TV shows. And like, I've known him for years, and he's very disarming and charming and magnetic and just like bitingly funny and is like a good time. So I said right away, I want George to come aboard. I made my dream list. I always wanted mm-hmm. to work with Michael Chernus. I've always wanted to work with Sam Richardson. Milana and I have known each other for well over a decade. So I basically took these big swings with folks who I'd either met in the comedy community or tasked to my actors once they were cast. Hey, who do you want to come play your spouse? Who do you want to come play your husband, your partner? And specifically with George, he said, well, you know, I think Sarah Burns would be great. And so then he would have a buddy to bring to winter camp. And then Harvey Guillen, I said, who do you want to play your husband? He said, Cheyenne Jackson. And Cheyenne, I was like, holy shit. Wow. I hadn't thought of Cheyenne Jackson, but he's wonderful. He had just done Watchmen, you know, and I'd known mm-hmm. of him since the Broadway days. And so it was just, it was kind of a, it was a holistic venture, you know?
And I love that you cast Michaela Watkins too. I love her. I have loved her for years, ever since I saw her on SNL. Which, and I believe she was the one that got, when she got let go from SNL, she said Lorne Michaels told her it was because she was too funny, which I thought was interesting.
I'd buy it. Yeah. I would totally buy it. Yeah. She's also one of those like just incredible human beings who's kind of down for whatever, you know, I mean, this whole cast really, you know,
yeah.
Like, but yeah, just a wonderful human being who's just like down to clown, you know?
Yeah.
It was
great. Is this the type of movie where everybody comes on set and they just know exactly what this movie is, and it's to just, you know, they're just in their character at the moment? Or did you have to like round them up and say, this is sort of what I'm looking for, and they got it that way, you know, through trial and error or whatever?
Well, it's a great question. So first of all, you know, I'm a first time feature director. Not Werewolves is my second, but you know, all these sort of great established character actors, you know, established actors, they knew me for just this one film and like, you know, videos I'd done for College Humor. So first mm-hmm. of all, everybody was skeptical. They're like, mm-hmm. I'm going to do this werewolf movie in Fleischman's New York with, you know, this kid. So I shared everyone, not only with my director's deck, like my pitch book that basically said, you know, this, we're going to make Fargo if it were an Amblin film, you know, Knives Out with a werewolf, you know, and everybody kind of got it, you know?
Yeah.
And also that with a 12 person cast and a limited budget, you know, we're not always going to have two cameras. So it's going to be a lot about the group, the ensemble working together, that a group shot might turn into a close-up, or a close-up might turn into a, you know, shot of the whole room kind of a thing, and it'd be a bit of choreography and everyone working together, not close-up, 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 close-up. Everyone just kind of waiting for when they'd get their medium. I had phone calls with every actor, Sam especially, obviously, you know, he was kind of our first one aboard, our kind of leader, our guiding light, you know, to sort of set the tone and reassure him and everyone else, like, you're going to be taken care of, A, B, like, I will do all my prep, this isn't going to be some schlocky film, and I'll make sure that you're not going to get caught trying to be funny. Like, that's my big thing, and that's how I think I'm able to balance like horror comedy so well. Why people are like, how do you do it? Well, for what it is you don't get caught trying to make jokes, and you play the emotional stakes and scares for real, you know? And they like luckily trusted me, and here we are.
Well, I was just gonna say that was the one thing I thought was interesting. I've seen Scare Me as well, which I love, by the way. And I love I don't know what that is, but I like how you kind of leave, like, I'm trying to think of how to say this. It kind of plays on the edge of whether or not it's horror or not for quite a while. And then you kind of find out, you know, at the end, like, that's almost part of the mystery too, right? And, in both of the movies, I noticed you did that really well. So I thought that was great.
Thank you. I think it's just, again, you have to know what you're getting into, and you have to know what you're saying. You can't just like, I tell it to people who, you know, ask me advice, you know, like, what should I make? What should I do? And how should I do it? And it's like, well, you got to write to some level of truth and groundedness mm-hmm. and not really have any kind of, sort of confusion about that, or dilution about what you're trying to say. Otherwise you'll end up with the 30% Rotten Tomatoes, because you're kind of, you know, your vision is split. You think you're either writing cool or making a film just for the sake of just kind of making something, which you can't do, tempting as it is if you're, you know, given the chance. So, you know, same thing goes with just with tone. It's like, you've got to know what you're saying, and you've got to be the, you know, the open nerve to receive and be the barometer for what's too much and too little.
How did you get involved with this project? What was the, were you there from the beginning, or how'd this all start?
Not the beginning. The beginning was Ubisoft. Basically, Margaret Boykin had sort of begun this women's fellowship program, TV and film, a fellowship writing program that Mishna's script was developed through. And it's an incredible program. And Mishna basically had her run of the archive to sort of go, I want this title to kind of write whatever I want, you know, in any sort of sense spiritually about any IP. And she picked Werewolves Within and thought it would be, might be a relevant sort of arachnophobia-esque like movie, like tale there. And, you know, Fargo-esque, and she, she did it. And then, you know, they started looking for directors, and it was just this kind of serendipitous thing where the producers who work at Vanishing Angle, Matt Miller and Natalie Metzger, who are the folks behind Thunder Road and Jim Cummings' other film, Wolf of Snow Hollow, they were buddies.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And so they were working on another werewolf film, first of all. But they were like, they came to see very graciously, very generously agreed to come give notes at a Scare Me test screening, like when Scare Me was even fatter than it is now, 2 hours and 12 minutes or whatever. And they gave notes on it, but they were kind of like, holy shit, this guy can make a contained movie sort of interesting. This might be the proper tone for this other thing that we're pitching on as production company. Would you be interested to toss your hat in the ring? And so when I read the script, I sort of winced at the idea of what I thought would be like a video game movie, quote unquote. You know, they don't have a great reputation. Mm-hmm. And from page one, it was just flat out everything I ever wanted in a film, loved in movies growing up, you know, Spielbergian, but with that esoteric kind of Coensy sort of spin. I pitched on it and I won the gig, and the rest is Hal story, you know.
Nice. You came prepared with all the puns today, and I appreciate that.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
It's funny, you know, I've watched this movie twice, and by the way, you mentioned Wolf of Snow Hollow. I think people should watch both of these movies back to back. It would be a very interesting double feature, I think, because it's interesting how you both made you know, small town werewolf movies, but they're such different in tone and everything. Even though his is funny too, it's just that I think those would be interesting back to back, because it's amazing how much material you can mine from this one simple premise and have that much material going on and anything. Anyway, after watching this the second time, I was like sitting there. First time I went through it, I was like, this is very Edgar Wright. This seems very Edgar Wright to me. There's something in the editing going on here and whatever. And I thought I was being really smart thinking that up. And then I went back and read your press release and realized that you had some, you mentioned Hot Fuzz in this. You also mentioned Arachnophobia and the Coen brothers and everything. But, the one thing that stood out to me was the influence of Edgar Wright definitely is over this movie, especially in the editing and how you use sounds to punctuate scenes and everything. Is this really difficult to get a handle on, like, to do it like this, to do a movie like this, edit it like this, shoot it?
The style did, even to like Taika Waititi's sort of acerbic, sort of punchy, paced up sort of style as well. Like Hunt for the Wilder People is a great example of one that really hit me, that, you know, makes you feel, but also takes you on a bit of a, something of a genre ride. And yeah, I always sort of felt it kind of paced up to a degree, but it's achievable really only with the proper team. You have to have people who believe in you, that you can transition scenes with very, very trim footage, that you only, you know, like trust that you can make your 12 person producing team or 6 person producing team trust you, that you won't need reshoots, that I just need these 3 shots to make, you know, to make our audience understand, or, you know, be transportive, to, you know, relay a certain amount of information. Brett Bachman, our editor, who also edited Mandy, and The Vigil, and is about to do the Toxic Avenger film for Legendary. Like, Brett is already so stylish and visceral. Sound is very important to him. So, you know, not every editor will go through and sort of put in the legwork to lay in sound, because they go, well, the sound designer is just going to come in here and eviscerate everything I do anyway. But, you know, he had a relationship with Owen Granich Young, who's our sound designer on this film anyway. And so he sort of knew already that we were going to kind of be working tangentially more or less. And, you know, oh yeah, Owen will, you know, up this, or he's familiar with this archive sound, isn't that the other thing? So anyway, it's a combination of knowing, like, storyboarding those moments to imbue or enact an Edgar Wright-esque, like, transition. You can't just say, yeah, we're gonna make it, you know, in the edit.
Right.
They're best mm-hmm. when you include the tilt up, the tilt down to infer the camera movement and then add the sound. So you gotta plan for it. You can't just, and I did that. I'm absolutely to blame for that in moments and Scare Me, where I thought, oh yeah, we'll just slide the beer into frame and then, you know, pop the cap off and it'll feel just like Shaun of the Dead, where it doesn't, because I didn't get that kind of alternate shot of the cap, mm-hmm. you know, to really make it feel like a visceral beat.
Yeah.
Whereas here, it's, I knew I wanted, you know, Sam to turn his head a certain way and then to whip into the binoculars and push into the binoculars and then have his hand come in and then pull it out. You're building Legos, you know. And Brett, Brett only made it better. Brett, you know, like your Wright-esque or your punchy editing and sound and, you know, the viscerality of it all is only as good, I think, as your filmmaking, sure, but your editor just kind of being down for the cause is everything. And Brett might as well be a producer on this film. I defer to him so much. He helped me build out this thing so much. Mm. He's so responsible for, you know, for the style. He even did the titles, you know, the beautiful, like, sort of Beetlejuice-esque font.
The sounds in this movie, like, I didn't notice it the first time because one thing that I think this movie does is I think it rewards multiple viewings and, you know, I didn't notice the first time when they're talking to Glenn Fleshler, you know, when he says freedom, there's an eagle that you can hear in the background. And and then there's the point where Rebecca Henderson, who's another great part of this cast, is talking through a hole in the door and telling everybody what she's found, and she knows something. And you can hear in the background all this commotion, and someone says, what did her eyeball say? this is the type of stuff I love. Like, I think in lesser movies, they realize that's a funny line, so they want to make sure that, you know, they cut to somebody saying that or whatever. But in this case, you let the viewer sort of just hear this as a part of the commotion, and it makes it so much more funny to do that. How much of this is just ADR or just something you happen to catch? Is it like, you know, scenes you shot, or is it what's the other? There's a lot of improv going on. Is it in the script? How do you create these moments?
Well, that's an awesome question and a great observation. So with something like, what that eyeball say, that's bringing in George to ADR and him mm-hmm. being his improvising, you know, a brilliant improviser self. When I task him to say, react, you know, in the crowd to this news, he'll just toss that out and we go, holy shit. Well, that's the funniest thing I've ever heard. Whereas, you know, in the cafe, the wonderful trailer moment that we have where, you know, Finn goes, well, it looks like we're having a good old fashioned sleepover. And George says, with guns, yes. So there's with guns though. And with guns, yes, is improv. That's not only George tossing out that improv, but Sam being a, you know, comedian superhero and picking right up on the heels of that and improvising, not missing a beat with guns, yes. And it ends up being mm-hmm. this kind of magical moment. As a director, you got to be willing to catch all of it, inform all of it, allow it, support it. And here, look what you end up with. It's, I couldn't have thought of that, you know. What did I about say?
Yeah, it just adds so much depth to everything that you're watching. I love this.
Yeah, the moral of the story is, you know, hire Sam Richardson and George Basil, you know, and really all the rest of them.
Yeah.
I can't tell you one actor that didn't offer some kind of wonderful, you know, improv or magical moment. That's a wonderful thing about this cast.
Yeah. You said you shot this in upstate New York. Is that where you shot it?
Yeah, that's where I'm from. That's why I'm going to treat it like Shyamalan treats Pennsylvania. I'm just going to try and keep going back to the Hudson Valley, because it's where I, you know, as a chubby, friendless kid who had a big imagination, it's where I played. It's where I shot at imaginary monsters with my cap gun in the woods. And it's where, you know, I hope to drive back some commerce. You know, I love it. I think it's a magical place.
Yeah. How did you find this location? What was it about it that said this is the place that I'm going to shoot this movie?
We always knew. I think Ready or Not had come out just before we went into production, and the Mishnah's script. You know, it's so the Beaverfield Inn specifically just so leapt off the page as being kind of a dark, labyrinthine, mm-hmm. sort of cozy, firelit house. And we did a pretty hefty location scout in October of, I guess it was 2019, all over that area. And my fiance had sort of at the last minute said, you know, I went to this New Year's Eve party at this place called Spillion, which is basically it's like a bed and breakfast and events space. And as soon as we walked in, it felt like everything we ever wanted and then some. It had such character to it. It felt like a location in Clue. It felt mm-hmm. like an old mm-hmm. wooden mansion. It reminded me too, in a weird way, of, this is so obscure, but So I Married an Axe Murderer concludes in this kind of San Francisco. You know, this like mansion. Yeah. And even though that was like a brighter palette, like this one kind of reminded me of it. So anyway, it was perfect. And down to the production sort of support of the space as well. It just kind of went on and on. We knew we could put, you know, whatever, honey wagons and a production office and makeup in the attic and high ceilings and, you know, the artwork and everything. And also the owner, Mark, was just so wonderful to work with. Thank you, Lauren. Yeah, thank you, my fiance.
Here's an interesting thing to me too. And I don't know if this is a purposeful thing or if it's just due to budget or whatever, but I find it interesting in this movie that there are no cops and there are no hospitals or anything that enters into the fray. Like it's weird. I'm glad that there's not. I'm glad that there aren't any cops or hospitals in this movie, because you have to keep your cast together and everything like that. But was that ever addressed? Was that something that, like, you know, somebody said, "Hey, what's the deal? The guy's hand gets bitten off. Shouldn't he be run to a hospital?"
I think if anything, I think there were probably lines that were a bit expositional, like, you know, as soon as the snow melts or as soon as the ice clears or whatever, we can, you know, get on a snowmobile and head down the mountain and get help or whatever. And there were earlier drafts that sort of drove that home. But the more we just kind of kept going through pages, the more we're kind of like, this is The Shining. I mean, in a way, it's like, you don't need all that stuff. Mm-hmm. You can just kind of end on this fun climax and this great note. And you're creating a world. I mean, it is sort of it's funny that it's a video game adaptation technically. And we sort of inadvertently ended up making this sort of cartoon world, this live action sort of a cartoon world where people can just get, you know, just die off. There's no mention of cell phones. Like, you know, I love that stuff. One conversation I had too with like my wardrobe designer, Dave Tabbert, was make these guys look like action figures, you know, make Sam look sort of timeless in his, you know, his forest green coat with not too much business on the badge and everything else. And everything's sort of very, you know, make it feel like, you know, Lincoln Log, you know, characters or something. And it sort of lends itself to all that logic, I suppose.
Was the video game adaptation aspect of it, was that ever, like, did they want you to include certain things, or were you able to pretty much just kind of do whatever you wanted with it? I've never played the game, so I don't know if there's anything, you know, like, stuff hidden in there that, you know, references it or anything like that.
It's so funny. This was the wonderful thing about Ubisoft. Jason Altman especially, you know, sort of basically runs the entertainment contingent over there, along with Margaret Boykin and Andrew Lieberman. But I was the one to come in and go, what do I owe you? You know, even though the game, which is a social deduction game where you are in the circle sort of going, you know, who's the werewolf. Even though it takes place in a completely different time, it's sort of fantasy based. It's, you know, takes place at the foot of a castle, the bottom of a medieval, you know, village in the valley of a medieval town. They said, no, you don't owe us anything. You just owe us a good movie. And so I was the one to be awesome. Like, well, the movie fan in me, especially based on any IP, especially based on a video game, wants Easter eggs. So I was the one to sort of go, I asked Ubisoft to curate kind of a book of all of the assets from the game so that I could show my production designer, Brett Tanzer, and go, okay, well, what artwork, what kind of nods can we bring in? We were able to do that. There's a book that's very integral to the game, sort of a menu book of, you know, a key. And that exists in the lobby. There's some artwork and other sort of Easter eggs and stuff, but it was, I ultimately ended up being more for me than any, that's, you know, cool. I think than anybody else, which is so cool. That's crazy. You know,
what was this set like? Was everybody surprisingly just all business, or was it loose? Or what was the sort of vibe that was on the set?
From the get-go, it was warm and friendly. I mean, I'll say it again, like winter camp. And I think that has so much to do with the fact that I built it out from the place of I want talented people. I want the funniest people I know, but I want friends, and I want good people. And so even just in kind of bringing in the two or three good people, quote unquote, that I knew personally, it was magic that Michael Chernus, who I've always wanted to work with, also turns out to be one of the most grounded, most wonderful, you know, people that Sam, as cordial and kind of genuine as he is on a show like Veep, or really in any performance he's ever done, that he actually is that kind, cool, nice, as much of a leader in real life as he is in the film. It lent itself to being a very friendly, fun set. And it was, what was great was that they almost all fanned over each other from various projects. Everyone kind of knew of each other because they're almost all at the same level. You know, there was no like Bruce Willis to come in who was like, you know, overshadowing anyone. Everyone was kind of like, all kind of in awe of each other and all sort of at the same level. And so everyone was just kind of joking. Like they were, you know, they wouldn't all retreat to a dressing room or anything. Everyone just hang out in the living room for shooting in the living room, or stay to read with each other, because what the hell else am I going to do? Hang out in the cold attic, or, you know, whatever. yeah. That's the best kind of environment to create. And I'd never have it any other way. From night one, when we read through the script, following into the next day, when we were just getting going, you know, it was all hands. And that's on your director and your producers too, but your director to be like, this is about teamwork. This is about this kind of energy. I brought them on the tour. Like after we walked through some of the bigger scenes, just kind of loosely read through, no pressure, some of these scenes, just kind of answer questions for the actors and stuff. I took everyone on, it's my favorite memory, I think, of the movie and making it, was I took all the actors on a tour of the house. Just us, just, you know, the 12 of us, 11 of us. I think Glenn hadn't yet come up yet. And I would walk them through the hall. I'd say, this is where this is going to happen. This is where this shit's going to go down. This is Ellis's room. This is where the lab is, you know. And everyone just so appreciated it. And, you know, like Michaela was so moved by it. We took a picture up there. It was just like really, really nice. And you kind of realize that, and I realized this is my time as an actor. Not every director is going to walk you through and take the time to explain themselves. It just often they treat actors like cattle, regardless of how sort of you know, regal they are and the like. And that's no other way I'd rather be than how we had it on this film. I think that ends up being a testament to the energy of it all.
I'm not going to ask you to speak for someone else or anything, but why don't we see Milana Weintraub in more things? Like, I know that she's not hurting or anything. She's not hurting, but like, why don't we see her in more, like, bigger movies and everything? Because I get this sense that big studios are like, oh, well, everybody's going to just be like, that's the AT&T girl. What is, you know, how are we going to get people to get beyond that and everything? Do you have any idea why that is?
I don't want to answer for her. It's a question for Milana, but I will say it's so funny just to use the word unfair with how successful Milana has been in her career, in her commercial career. But she, you know, I don't know. I mean, she's one of the funniest goddamn people I know and so kind. I mean, you look at her humanitarian work and the fact that she could make a better fart joke, not just a funnier fart joke, but like a better fart. Like she's one of the guys and the girls. She's one of everyone and can just like, you know, she could get down and clown like anybody else. And it's just, I don't know. I think that this whole business is such a lottery anyway. I mean, she in every respect is eons more successful than me. But she hadn't necessarily had many opportunities like this before. And I think it was part of the thrill of my kind of going, oh my God, now I get to show or I get to provide a vehicle for my friend I've known for a long time for what she can do. And that is what's so exciting. Like, I really hope this is a new chapter for her. And I love that. I love when, like, I remember years ago, this is obscure. I know you guys will know this reference, but when Greg Kinnear was the talk soup guy.
Yeah.
And then he did.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then he did, not Something's Gotta Give. Oh my God. The Jack Nicholson film with the,
As
Good As It Gets. Oh. When he did As Good As It Gets and he turned, everybody kind of went, holy shit. I really hope this is As Good As It Gets kind of move for her. I really do. And I think it can be, it's possible to jump from, you know,
I was just sitting there just going, I understand what, like, if you've seen these, you know, commercials for years, they've been on forever and ever and ever, and she plays Lily and all this, but like, I watching this movie, it wasn't like, I wasn't sitting there going, AT&T girl, AT&T, I wasn't like sitting there thinking that. She immediately gets away from that, even though she's still playing a nice, you know, gentle person and everything like that. I don't know. Sometimes you just root for people a lot of times, and this is one of those times, because I think she's, I mean, I think she's great in those commercials, and then to, you know, and then in this movie, she's phenomenal. So, I'm hoping it's a springboard for her as well. I feel like I could talk about your whole cast forever. I'm going down up and down this cast list, and Glenn Fleshler has become one of my favorite character actors. I've seen him in Billions. I saw him on Barry. He was in Joker.
Yeah.
He's somebody that I don't think I've ever seen him play a character like this. I don't know if he even I would have never guessed he had this kind of dry humor, playing such a serious person, quote unquote, and everything. Could you talk about him a little bit? Just let's throw some light on Glenn Fleshler.
Hell yeah. I mean, I had my phone call with him. There was actually kind of a scary moment where, you know, we reached out to him and they had to turn us down, him and his team, because it was pilot season. He was like, I might hit a jackpot out here. I don't know if I can go out and do this sort of, you know, this indie film in the woods with you. And then he came back around and said, actually, I think I can do this. And we all like cheered. I had my call with him. My question to all the actors on the phone was, how do you like to work? How do you like to be talked to? How do you like to be directed? Because some people will say, you know, Sam will say, hey, you know, I'm really easy, but, you know, don't tell me how to, you know, don't do a like a line reading for a joke, you know, without like saying he's a comedic superhero. He's a comedic superhero. And I'm like, oh yeah, of course. You know, like Michael Chernus might just want to know, you know, what level of creep factor or whatever. And pretty much everybody is like, whatever. Milan is like, literally move my arms. Like, tell me what to do. I don't care. Ragdoll my, you know. Right. And Glenn was like, I've worked with every director. I've worked with every actor. I'm pretty easy. I'm excited to just like kind of do this character part. You meet this dude. Glenn is a gentle giant, but you are in the presence of the Yellow King. I mean, you know, he's got these kind of, I don't want to say dead eyes, but he like has that dead eyed stare. And then he starts talking mm-hmm. and he's like the sweetest dude. He's quiet. And I wonder if part of that was his kind of being character for Emerson, but we were just texting him the other day because we're ready to go to Tribeca together. And I said, hey, you know, whatever you're comfortable with, I'm down for hugs, elbow bumps, fist pumps, handshakes, high fives. And he just writes all the above, baby, period. You know, it's like, man, gotta love Glenn. Just like glacially warm. And he was just so gracious to sit at lunch with like his, you know, the beard adhered to his face and answer questions about like working with Michael Shannon on Waco and about being in the presence of Joaquin working on Joker. That's a real deal character actor. Cause he can, you know, make you bust ass laughing on Barry, but then scare the hell out of you on, you know, the handful of other things where he's.
Mm-hmm. And we've mentioned Sam Richardson many times throughout this podcast. I don't think we've really talked enough about him, maybe possibly, to really get down in the dirt. I love how in this movie everything about him is sort of a criticism about being nice and everything. I loved his speech at the end, by the way, because it's like, yeah, I mean, you're going to call somebody out for being nice. I thought it was also kind of funny that they played on this in Promising Young Woman when he shows up in that movie, as well. They played on his niceness in that. But anyway, talk about Sam, because I feel like this is another guy. When I first saw him in Veep, I was like, where the hell did this guy come from? Like, he just came out of nowhere. I mean, you would think that there's no way you can improve Veep at all. And then he shows up and just has all these great dry one-liners and everything. But anyway, yeah, talk about him.
Comes from the improv scene, you know, out of Detroit. He's like a Detroit guy through and through. I mean, Detroiters, he's not only a stellar mm-hmm. improviser and a great guy, but he's also a producer and a writer. He understands comedy and the business of it all. And he's a genre dude. He's like, he loves werewolves. Werewolf movies. He loves, mm-hmm. yeah, he's, you know, he's a nerd, you know, and with this role, it was really exciting to go to him and hear him say, you know, this is something people don't usually come to me and have me helm. I'm usually the buddy, you know, to have him come aboard and play the hero, and go through everything that Finn does kind of through the film and play it to the top of his game. I've been using this, butchering this quote from Guillermo del Toro, but he did a DGA question and Q&A with the guy who wrote and directed Barb and Star, The Vista Del Mar, which is a very, very funny movie. He was talking about comedic actors, Guillermo del Toro, and how they operate at the top of their game, like with 100% of their kind of gears firing, because they're not only automatically using and utilizing their comedic superpowers, but they're also then tapping into their acting chops, playing dramatic circumstances and the like. And that is Sam. Sam was operating at 100%. Not only as a producer, but as an actor, with his dramatic chops, playing emotional stakes for real and his vulnerability for real.
Mm-hmm.
But like when he was allowed to, or when it was appropriate to play at the top of his comedic game, you have this character that is just like so disarming, charming, wonderful. And everybody gets their kind of Agatha Christie mm-hmm. moment. He's still a suspect, which is what's so exciting about really every member of the cast too. Everyone kind of has their opportunity to, you know, turn a right cheek into a shadow.
I was just going to say, I love that too about the movie, how there are little details all throughout. Like there's a character called Wolfson, There's you know, because when there was just that casual mention of somebody's name, I was like, oh, maybe, possibly, I don't know. But like, everybody seems to have their own motives and everything. It's kind of like Scream in that way, and so, like how Scream always seemed to find a way to, you know, make everybody a suspect in that movie just through tiny details and everything. Anyway, Jonathan, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you did a couple of, the murder mystery aspect of this is really well done. Was that something that intrigued you about this? Are you a murder mystery fan? Is that definitely something that you wanted to highlight, I guess?
I'm a murder mystery fan, but I'm intimidated by the complexity of the, you probably won't see me write a whodunit, because it's a complicated venture. You're writing 10, 12 suspects, different motives, characters, and the like. If it's a little more contained, a little more intimate, yeah, I'll take a swing, but it's a testament to Mishna's proficiency in the genre. I'm less of a Gosford Park guy and more of a Clue guy, you know, in terms of the color buoyancy, pacing, and style. I'm also just a bit more dense kind of overall. So I think that was an all hands on deck effort, you know, but I think that the script was just, it was just so there. I was able to come in and do kind of a director's pass on it to really kind of make explicit certain moments, drive home certain winks to the audience and the like, and keep the suspects, the plate spinning in terms of who might be our murderer as long as we possibly could. So I love it. I'd be happy to do another one. If this is my brand, you know, I'd be happy to keep playing in the space, but it's intimidating to helm as a writer. I can't imagine you have to have multiple personalities as it is and as an actor, but as a writer to kind of get in and all the different kind of, you know, colors of an archetype. It's really something.
I love the Clue reference, though. I love how you keep mentioning Clue, because that's one thing I thought about. Just because you've got current comic actors at the top of their game playing off each other in this kind of setting, I'm kind of shocked more people haven't done this, or maybe they have and they just haven't done it well. But I definitely had a lot of Clue vibes in a good way when I was watching this. So
there's a pretty awesome comedy. I wouldn't even call it underwatched or underrated, but I think Jason Bateman's Game Night, it's a very
different movie.
Is so,
yeah, we're huge,
probably
fans of that.
Close. But I mean, like, as a comedy with, like, kind of, you know, a few twists and turns, it's an out and out comedy, you know, kind of action film. But that's probably the closest I can think of recently. Next to Ready or Not, of course, not Ready or Not and Knives Out have kind of, they were in production, if not coming out by the time we went into production, kind of going like, oh boy, is this going to be sort of trodden? And luckily it separates, if not supports, the fact that, you know, this is a tried and true and successful sort of style of filmmaking and story, and excited to be a part of it.
I asked this of a lot of directors, what was your hardest day on set?
Oh man, that's easy. Well, I guess there were a couple. There was one day when we were on Main Street, when Finn and Cecily are just kind of meeting everybody, and we were raced. That was one day. We had one day to go from setup to setup to setup, making our way down Main Street in Phoenicia, New York. We had one camera, and so we are flying through people's scenes and coverage, and not enough time to improvise and play. And it's Michaela's first day and stuff like that. It was really tough because you can't, you know, you can only do the best you can as a director to support your actors, but you can't keep the sun in the sky any longer that, you know, than it is. So that was probably the hardest day, I think, you know, just for me, feeling like I wish I could have supported everyone to the fullest extent. But, you know, you only have so many resources. You're always going to be fighting the sun. And sometimes you got to say, too bad. You know, we got what we need. Trust me. And then I'd say the other one is, like, without giving anything, you know, away, when stunts get involved and you only have so many takes before it might, you know, hurt your stunt person's rib, or it might be a little too much on your stunt person to, you know, bound off some surface or whatever else. You gotta really be particular about your takes and your coverage, and know when you got it, when enough is enough.
I absolutely love this movie. I hope find a huge audience for it. And like I said, I could probably pick out a million different actors and we could talk about them for 5 to 10 minutes. And I almost feel bad that we didn't get around to a lot of them or whatever. But I guess we still have a few minutes. I just don't want to just leave. I want to leave anybody out. But. Let's talk about Rebecca Henderson a little bit. She plays another interesting character in this, and the way that you present her in this is amazing because she always seems to pop out as a surprise in this movie. Tell me about her a little bit because I've seen her before, but I don't know if I had registered her before this. So yeah, tell us about her.
It's funny. So first of all, Dr. Ellis was written for, Richard Jenkins, David Thewlis type, it was very, very clear from the get-go. And without tooting any horns or, beating my chest or patting myself on the back too much, I do have a responsibility as a director, as a Caucasian 37-year-old male director, to cast as diversely as I can. That obviously pertains to our main character. Sam, very well could have been, a Caucasian male lead. He didn't have to be. And in fact, the fact that he's an African-American character, that he's a Black man in a predominantly white town, that only adds texture to it. And that's accurate too. That's the town the towns I grew up in. You can really feel like an outsider regardless of what you look like. If you're not from, upstate, you can truly feel like you're not one of them. And that only adds to the circumstances. And as far as Dr. Ellis is concerned, I thought, well, we've already seen a Richard Jenkins type do this role. Why don't we see Rebecca, who destroyed me in Russian Doll? I've known her wife, Leslie Headland. I've sort of fanned over her for a bit. I just knew in what Rebecca had popped up in, Russian Doll kind of being the most recent example, where she was just kind of a secret weapon as an actor, a jack of all trades. If you need someone to play drama at the top of their game, she can play drama at the top of her game, like pull tears, play terror, whatever it is. Humor, she is so sharply funny. I felt probably the most guilty in regards to her scenes throughout throughout the entire film, because she was always kind of lurking in the dark and kind of in her own sort of world, and we only had so much time. You got to knock out what you knock out with the majority of cast, and you've got your kind of one-off brief scenes with Dr. Ellis, and so her stuff, rushed as it was always performed to the absolute most proficient skill. Like, she is so damn funny and so so good. I saw her in an off-Broadway plays in New York as well. I just knew she could kind of play a character who might be a bit antisocial, not would have much of a social filter, get a bit in their head, play that paranoia super well, but also be able to spin the plates and balance the line, toe the line of humor and drama. And she did. She nailed it. And I'm glad we took a different route there with her. She killed it. Makes me laugh every time Finn turns and reveals her,
Oh, she's so good. So good.
Hi.
Oh, I'm so awesome. And just that, hi.
I literally don't know what's going on. Yeah.
I don't know. Jonathan, you have anything else?
Well, I did. I was curious too. I mentioned the murder mystery aspect, but you also made a really good werewolf movie, which is not something that apparently is very easy to do because we don't have a ton of them. So was that something that interested you as well? Like, are you were talking about Sam being a werewolf movie fan. So,
yeah, I mean, we, what can I say? I mean, I knew it was definitely appealing. I knew what I wanted out of it as a werewolf lover. You already get that inherently with, you know, the kind of reveal, oh, we haven't quite seen this as much,
this sort
of route, this sort of approach, A. But B, I knew that, you know, immediately I wanted to make sure that the performer came out through the prosthetics, that the prosthetics didn't, or the werewolf suit didn't overshadow or cake my actor, that you actually got to see facial expressions. I mean, in kind of an old school way, I guess you could see,
yeah,
could emote through all of that. And we were able to do that, which I think was wonderful. It was awesome working with Constantine Sakaris. He was our, Constantine is our creature effects dude. And he was so gracious to come aboard and work on this film, because he's used to working on, you know, $100 million movies, of which this was not one. And he was just excited. He's a werewolf fan. He's like, wow, I haven't seen this quite, you know? So, to work with him and to just kind of give him the skin of what I was looking for, and then just let him go for it, was a thrill.
Very cool.
You would think it was a good one, then success, you know?
Absolutely. No. Yeah. That seems to be like the horror movie fan. That seems to be the common trope, you know, there's not enough good werewolf movies. So it's nice when one comes along. And yeah, for sure.
No spoilers, but I do enjoy the weapon that was eventually used on the werewolf at the end of this movie. especially because Sam Richardson is lying there, and I don't know if his whatever he says right after that, which is like "what the hell" or something to that nature, whatever. It's a line that could be talking about the situation, but it could also be talking about the weapon that was used in this scene and everything too. I was saying like "what the hell," you know, that type of thing. What a nice touch. Anyway, it doesn't seem like any stone was left unturned in this movie, and I hope everybody goes out to see this when it's available. All right. We'd like to thank Josh Rubin for coming onto the Sincast today. Thank you so much for talking with us today. It was great getting to know more about your movie. The movie is Werewolves Within. It comes out in theaters. What theaters can we watch this in on June 25th? Is this a limited run?
That's a great question. I know that we're up to like 70, so it ain't limited. They're kind of
awesome.
They're kind of going to be a bit.
Oh, old. Okay.
So check your local listings. You know?
Oh, okay.
I know we're coming to Alamo here in Los Angeles, and I'm thrilled about that. That's a bucket list item for me, but they're all over the country.
Oh, that'll be badass. It'll be in theaters June 25th, on demand July 2nd. That's going to do it for this interview. It's Chris Atkinson and Jonathan Watkins. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.